It's time now for Sunday Fireside, a weekly feature of this radio station as we present inspirational talks and discussions on religious topics from popular LDS speakers and general authorities of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Two outstanding talks will be featured on Sunday Fireside today. First, a talk by Brother Victor Klein, Making Life Work for You, and a conference talk by Elder Neil A. Maxwell, dealing with dedication to the Lord. First, a talk by Brother Victor Klein, a professor of psychology at the University of Utah. The title of his talk today, Making Life Work for You. This talk was delivered at the Ephraim LDS Institute of Religion back in February 28, 1991, as part of their Friday Forum series. Our first speaker on Sunday Fireside, Brother Victor Klein.
I grew up in Southern California, and one of the things I really loved about living there was the beaches. And so I became kind of an addict to the going body surfing in the Southern California surf. And I found there was one beach there in particular that I really loved better than all the rest, and that was Huntington Beach. The reason why was because the surf was so huge. The breakers were just monstrous. It was exciting and wonderful and very thrilling to do a lot of body surfing with these huge breakers that would come in at that particular beach. And it was fun to, plow right into them as they, just as they were crashing or whatever, and then swim back with them and that kind of thing. And, those breakers just kept coming in and coming in and coming in 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. They never stopped coming. It was really exciting, the challenge, of crashing into them and swimming into them. And, I think it's just sort of like life in general, and that is life is nothing but a series of challenges, a series of stresses, a series of problems sometimes, a series of things that constantly, in a sense, challenge our ingenuity, our intelligence, our spirit, and things like that. And it's like some of you will have a huge test coming up next Wednesday. Well, guess what? You study hard and you do well on the test, but then there's something else coming up. And then there's another kind of a problem or a challenge. You have a relationship that's not going well. And so you have the challenge of making that work. And so I thought, the beach is kind of like life, and that is it never stops coming. The challenges and the difficulties and the excitement and the interesting things and so forth that you have to deal with, that you have to handle. And then one thing I learned about the surf at the beach was that about every 30th wave is a humongous one, just not an ordinary wave, but it is a monster, super monster. And when that hits you, it just knocks you flat. And guess what? That's exactly what happens in life too. And that is every once in a while, in addition to the regular stresses and problems and challenges and so forth, we all get hit by one of these humongous waves, And that's just kind of the way life is. Reminds me of a man by the name of Russell Redenbaugh. In fact, he spoke to our students at the University of Utah several years ago. And when he was in his senior year in high school, a terrible thing happened to him. In his chemistry class, somehow or another, they mixed some of the wrong chemicals together, and there was a tremendous explosion, and he lost his eyesight permanently. So that meant that for the rest of his life, he would be blind. He happened to be one of the super scholars, super students, super achievers. And all of a sudden, he had a great life ahead of him, and all of a sudden, this explosion just totally tore out of his face, his eyesight, his vision. And so he had to face the problem of how to deal with that, how to handle that. Well, anyway, he decided that even if he was blind, he was still going to find a way to go to college, to a university. And he did. And then he graduated from there in business. And he decided, I'd like to go to Stanford, or I'd like to go to a place like Harvard. And so he applied there. And he applied a number of different places. But they all turned him down, and he said, a blind person won't be able to make it here. It's too tough. They wouldn't let him come there. So he was really very discouraged. So he stayed on at the University of Utah, and he did get his MBA degree. And then he had the problem of going out and finding a job. Now, somebody who's in accounting, who's in a business career, you know, a vision would be very, very important, as you would scan business reports and sheets and so forth. And so he decided that he was going to be very successful in his life. So he started applying for work. And even though he had a very high grade point average, no matter where he applied, they said, "You're blind. We don't want you. You will not be able to make it here." And so anyway, he applied again and again. You know what? He applied at 55 different places before he finally got a job. But he did get a job. But he was turned down 55 times. And anyway, when we heard him a few years ago at the U, he had now become vice president of one of the very largest investment firms in America and doing a terrific job. And so what he wanted to do was to share with the students some of his ideas about what it takes to be successful. Even if you have a handicap, even if you have some problems in your life, even if you have some difficulties. And he said that in his experience, successful people, that is, people who cut the mustard, people who do the job, people that are successful, who like cream come to the top, you know. And there are people that are like that, that no matter where they go to the top, and they're successful. He said they got to have three things. The first is energy, power. The second is you've got to have strategies for success. In other words, you've got to have a plan. You've got to have a goal. You've got to be focused. You've got to know where you're going. If you don't have a plan, you'll just go in circles. I used to work at the University of Utah for 8 years in their counseling center. And I saw all kinds of people that had tremendous IQ, intelligence. You know what? But they were going in circles. They didn't have a plan. They didn't have a focus. So even though they had all this intellectual horsepower, it was for nothing. So first you've got to have the energy or the power, the drive. Then you've got to have the strategies for success. And the third thing you've got to do is you've got to have the ability to transform thought into action. In other words, you know, I see a lot of people who are dreamers. I see a lot of people who think, wouldn't it be great to do this or to do that or whatever? But not only do you have to have the plans, but you also got to have that ability to translate the plan into action so that you start moving in a particular direction. He said, success has nothing to do with how much you know. What gets rewarded is action. And to produce action, one must have energy. You have to have some personal power. And you know, we all know people that are good people, have good intentions, but if they don't have that personal power, then, you know, they go no place. And he said the one way you get power to gain energy is to act in ways that are consistent with your values and your belief. And you know what he's really saying is that if you're a phony, if you're pretending one thing but living a lie, you're cutting corners, you're out of integrity, he said what that does is that drains energy because you're constantly having to hide, to cover up. And we all know people that are like that are phonies, that are out of integrity, they do one thing, but they say another. And when you do that, it takes away your power. And in the end, you do not have the power to, again, in an effective way, translate your ideas and your plans and your goals into action. So what he's saying is that successful people must have strategies for success. Successful people are doing people. They're doing things. They aren't just hoping. Poor people hope. Rich people plan and then do. And people must plan to do what they like to do. In other words, what you need to do is especially in the career you go into, you want to do something that you really enjoy. And I know my work in psychology, I love it. Every morning I wake up, I look forward to what's coming in the coming day there. I do so many exciting things. My life is so wonderful and so exciting and so interesting and so challenging. I mean, it is really exciting. Now, I had a friend a few years ago, that challenges and excites him? And that is to make these asphalt roads out here, you know. That is the most fun thing in his life, to go out, and he's a road man, you know. And that's what turns him on. That's what excites him. Then there's other people that are cement people, and there are other people that are carpenters, and there are other people that are engineers. But whatever you do, you want to do something that's a kick, that's a joy, that's fun, that you love to do. In other words, I don't work, I just have fun all day. And that doesn't mean I don't, quote, work hard. I do. I work very hard, but it's not work. It is fun. I love what I do. It is so exciting and so interesting and so challenging. But there are other kinds of things that I would not like doing, like routine mechanical work. That would bore me to death. So what I'm saying is that in choice of career and the things you do and so forth, you want to choose things to do things that are exciting. And if you do, then you'll be like that cream. You'll go to the top and you'll become the very best at what you do. Whether you're constructing highways or you're a carpenter, or you're an engineer or a teacher or whatever it is. So do the things that you really enjoy doing. Now, another characteristic of successful people is personal power. In other words, that somehow or another you have an inner power that allows you to, again, translate your goals and your ambitions and your dreams into action. And you're not afraid to take some chances and some risks. And occasionally you won't succeed. In fact, I was talking with a gentleman that's incredibly wealthy and successful as a businessman. And he said, and I was asking him, I said, what do you count for your success? He said, you know, I love what I do, but I realize that about half the things I'm going to do, I'm going to fail. He said, I'm a very, very sharp businessman. But he said, you know, no matter how hard I work, about half the things I go into don't work out. They don't fail. In most cases, it's not necessarily my fault. You know, the times are against it or whatever. You know, I do the best I can. But if I do not succeed, if I do fail, I say, hey, what a great learning experience. In fact, I had a friend not long ago who told me about a new venture. He was a businessman that he went into. And he invested 18 months of his life and $70,000 in it. And he said he worked day and night. He said it was just stress, and whatever. It was an exciting adventure, you know, for him, this business that he went into. But at the end of about 18 months, it all collapsed. The government funding they thought they were going to get didn't occur and so forth. So he lost $70,000 and 18 months of his life. He said then he went into another business that succeeded marvelously. And then he said, you know, I now realize, but he said, I learned so much from that failure. He said, I learned how to handle attorneys, lawyers. I learned how to handle so many things, you know, from that failure experience. So now I look back on it, and I call it my $70,000 seminar. You know, I spent $70,000 on that seminar. But what it did, it taught me how to be successful, how to not make mistakes and do these things and these things and these things, you know. And so he said, that's why I'm making so much money now. And that is that I went through that painful kind of difficult experience. Now let me tell you, let's say you have a relationship, you have a boyfriend-girlfriend relationship, you have that doesn't work out, that goes sour, you know. Instead of thinking, oh, what a terrible thing happened to me, what you ought to say is, thanks, Father in heaven, you gave me such a wonderful experience, I've learned so much about human relationships, you know, the next time I'm in a dating relationship or whatever, I'm going to handle it so much better, you know. And so if you can look at some of the adversities, you know, just like with Russell Redenbach and his, you know, being blind and so forth, that didn't slow him down, that didn't stop him, he was still successful. So when you do have negative things happen to you, what you can do is think, oh, what a terrible experience. Or what you can do is say, thank you, Father in heaven, for helping me have a growth experience. And if you look at it that way, let me tell you, it can be a great positive event or step forward in your life. Let me just tell you a little story. A few years ago, there were a group of bricklayers in Salt Lake City. They were putting up a huge building. And around noontime, it was in summer, warm time of the year, very hot, and they went to in the shade of the building to sit down and have lunch. And each of them had brought a bag lunch. And this particular fellow, he opened up his lunch, and he pulled out a sandwich, and he bit into it. And I told this story before, but I want to tell it again because it is so important. And when he bit into the sandwich, he discovered that it was peanut butter. Now, this guy hated peanut butter. He said, peanut butter! I hate peanut butter! He you know, spit it out. He threw it on the ground, and he said, yuck. And he reached in again, and he pulled out another sandwich. Guess what? Another peanut butter sandwich. This time, he was outraged. Peanut butter! I hate peanut butter! I mean, this guy and all these buddies were laughing their heads off, you know, and they said, oh, come on, Charlie. You know, and so he threw the sandwich away, cursing and everything like that. One final sandwich. He pulled it out, and once again, peanut butter. This time, he just went berserk. He threw it on the ground. He stomped on it. Oh, he just went absolutely mad. And these guys were just laughing their heads off. And then finally, one of them said, hey, Charlie, hey, why don't you tell your wife, you know, to make a beef sandwich or jelly sandwich or liverwurst or something like that, you know. And he said, you keep my wife out of this. I made my own lunch today. Okay, gang, there is a moral there. And that is, if we have a lot of unhappiness in our life, at least in part, and maybe entirely, we are responsible. When things don't go well, we are responsible in most cases. Now, if you kind of, see, if you play the role of a victim, you know, that all the bad things that are happening to you are, you know, somebody else's fault, you know, there's no solution for you. You are doomed. But if you assume some responsibility for the pain you're in, or because relationships aren't working, or because your grades aren't good, or whatever, you see, as long as you're blaming it on the teachers or somebody else or bad luck or whatever, you know, as long as you're a victim, guess what? There's no hope for you. But as soon as you start saying, maybe I am partially responsible for it, guess what? Then you can start doing something. See, then you can initiate change. Then you can say, hey, I need to handle either relationships better or study habits, or I've got to do something in a sense to change or to improve. And so what I'm saying is that with the story of the peanut butter sandwich, let me tell you, you can shift. But if you play a victim role, if you think it's all somebody else's fault, you don't have a chance. Now, what I'd like to talk about is the power of the mind and the importance of right attitudes in making life work for you. I remember some years ago, as a graduate student at Berkeley, I went down to the life sciences building one day, one of the hallways there, and I saw a big sign up, and it said, wanted subjects for experiments in hypnosis. And I thought, well, no, I'm a graduate student in psychology, and I've never learned anything about hypnosis. Maybe what I'll do is sign up for this research. So I put my name down, and I came at the appointed hour, and they put me in a dark room, a nice, comfortable chair. And then this fellow said, okay. Incidentally, he gave us a physical exam before they did this research, make sure we're in good health. Then he said, all right, now what I want you to do is relax. Just totally relax. Your eyes feel very heavy. You're very drowsy. Just relax. Just relax. Now watch it. Be careful now. Okay. Anyway, finally he induced a hypnotic state. And in this hypnotic state, what they wanted to do was induce different kinds of emotions and see what effects these emotions would have upon our body, upon our heart. And so they hooked us up to electrocardiogram. Now this is the thing that maybe some of your folks who have had heart problems, you know, when they go to the doctor, they check the systole and diastole, you know, the rate and function of the heart, how it functions there. And they hook the machine up, you know, and they have these electronic tracers and whatever, you know. Well, that's what they did with us. And so what they wanted to do was to see what effect different emotional states would have upon our heart. And so they induced anger. They induced fear. They induced euphoria, feeling great, feeling wonderful. They went through a whole series of emotions. And then the very last emotion, which they induced in a heavy, deep hypnotic state, was, you are worried about your heart. It is malfunctioning. Something's wrong with it. You're terribly worried. Your life may be in danger. And they really did, with this powerful suggestion that something might be wrong with the heart. Well, you know what happened? Merely by suggesting that there was something wrong with our heart, they actually caused it to malfunction. So when the tracings came out, they were very distorted and disturbed. And when they took them over to the University of California Medical Center in San Francisco, several of the nation's leading heart specialists said, death within 24 hours. Death within 24 hours. That was many years ago. And so what they had demonstrated under hypnosis is that as a man thinketh, so is he. That if you think negatively about your body functions and so forth, that you could actually cause your heart to perform incorrectly. In fact, there's a lot of research lately that suggests that if you were thinking loving thoughts, that this increases the power of your immune system. It is more able to attack foreign antigens or those kinds of things which viruses and other kinds of things which might create a serious illness in you. And in fact, we have found there's some very careful, good research that suggests that if you go in for surgery and you're depressed, that greatly increases the risk that you would die during the surgery. And if you're in a deep depression, because what it does is it suppresses the immune system and all those functions in your body that would be there to serve you. And so how you think has a dramatic effect upon how your body functions and its health, basically. So what I'm suggesting is that when we have difficult times come to us, I think that we need to be able to see the good side of it, that we need to be able to do those things that allow us to handle it so that we do not allow those things to disturb us. Or and it's kind of like a half full glass of water. You can look at it as, you know, half empty or half full. And it's up to us to determine how we do it. In fact, let me just tell you about a friend of mine, Bruce Solomon. He was telling about a fellow that jumped out of an airplane, one of those skydivers. And as he came down, he reached over and he pulled the ripcord. Well, whoever had packed the chute had done a terrible job and it didn't open. But he had a spare chute. So he reached over here and the spare chute, he pulled a ripcord. And guess what? Nothing happened. And so the same guy packed that chute. So it's very clear to this guy that he only had a very short time to live as he was coming down to Earth. And so he had a choice. What he could do is all the way down to Earth till he hit it and he would die. He could curse that guy, you know, that had packed the chute. Or what he could do is say, "Wow, what a beautiful day. Look at the view. Oh, this warm sun. Isn't it great?" You know? He had a choice. And you know what? All of us, in one way or another, are going down to Earth. And with some of us, we're going to hit sooner. And with others of us, it'll be a few years from now. But it doesn't make any difference when it is. So what we can do is we can appreciate the wonderful things, the blessings that we can have. Or what we can do is be angry about the difficult things that happen to us. But you know what? We have a choice. We have a choice. You know, I'm a clinical psychologist. I treat people with all kinds of problems and illnesses and things like that. And so one of the things oftentimes I'll do is go into the person's childhood. And you know, I have some people that what we'll do when they talk about their childhood is they say, "Well, my mom was mean to me and my dad was gone a lot." And all they can remember is only the bad things that happened to them. Then there are other people who have similar difficult things, challenges, pain at times. But you know what they do is they remember the good things, the wonderful things that happened to them, the joys they had and the positive experiences, you know. So whether you have a good childhood or a terrible childhood, in part depends on how you choose to look at it. You can remember the wonderful things, the good things, and they can become a part of your adult life. Or what you can do is be a chronic bitter complainer, be mad about it and so forth. And you know, I see people, adults like that, they're constantly grouchy, you know. They are what we call injustice collectors. They collect injustices. They're constantly looking for people to offend them, you know. And they just love to have people offend them in one way or another. And then they say, "See, look at this. These people are mean out here. They're this way and that way." Then there are other people, you know, they don't pay any attention to that. What they do is they see the good in other people. And they see the good things that happen in their life. And you know what? It's up to you. You can choose, again, to have a wonderful childhood, or what you can do is to choose to remember only the things that were difficult or wrong or whatever. Now, remember Joseph in Egypt, what happened to him. It's a wonderful story, and that is that he resisted the seductions of his employer's wife, Potiphar's wife. Remember, she tried to put the make on him, to seduce him. And you know what? He remained honorable. In fact, the Bible says he fled from her. She clutched onto him and even tore a fragment of his garment, you know. But he rejected her. He was loyal to his employer. He was not going to, in a sense, have an affair with his wife behind his employer's back. Now, what did Joseph get for this? For being honorable, for being righteous, for being good. Remember what his reward was? Jail for 2 years. Because Potiphar's wife, she said, well, he's going to reject me. I'm going to get him into trouble. So what she did was she went to her husband and she said, you know, this Jew who works for you, this Israelite, you know, he tried to make improper advances toward me. She lied, you know, just to get him into trouble. And so her husband, who really loved and liked and appreciated Joseph, he felt terrible, but he knew he had to do something about it, leaving his wife. So he had him cast into prison for 2 years. Now, according to the Bible, the Lord loved Joseph. He was a very special person. But, you know, he didn't immediately get him out of jail. He was there for 2 years. So oftentimes, even good, righteous people go through a period of testing or suffering or difficulty or whatever, you know. But eventually, guess what? He gets out and his life becomes incredibly blessed. And he becomes probably next to the Pharaoh, the man with the greatest power in the land, with great riches and with great wealth and that kind of thing. And so I think that we all go through tests and trials in life. And I believe, like Norman Cousin says, that a right attitude is like a bulletproof vest. And if you remember, he was the man that had cancer, who was formerly the editor of Saturday Review of Literature. And he helped heal himself while he was dying of cancer, or he thought he was dying, with humor and a positive mental attitude. And while he was in that UCLA hospital, what he did was he had them bring in all these comedy clips and films and so forth. So what he did was he just laughed and laughed, hour after hour, day after day, just laughed and laughed and laughed, you know. And guess what? He got better. Now, we don't know all the reasons he got better, but he rebuked. The change of mental attitude helped rebuke those cancerous cells. And then I remember when President Reagan, you know, a few years ago was the target of an assassin. And a man tried to kill him. And in fact, shot at him and actually wounded him. He didn't kill him. Anyway, they rushed him to the hospital, and it was on national TV. The whole country was shocked. And when his wife, Nancy, got to the hospital, she went into his bedroom, and there he was with a big grin on his face. He said, honey, I forgot to duck. You know? And she laughed, and he laughed, and, you know, the wound was not too serious. But he had a sense of humor about it. And then when he went into the surgery, when they were going to get the bullet out of him, you know, he looked up and he saw all these surgeons there looking down at him, and he said, please, fellas, tell me you're Republicans. Just before they operated on him. And again, they all laughed, broke up laughing. And then later on, he had a bout with cancer. And then after the tumor was removed, you know, he said, boy, I'm glad that's all out. You know? And again, a positive attitude, a terrific attitude, a wonderful attitude. So what I'm saying is that if you want to have life work for you, I think it's really important, you know, that you do create and cultivate a right attitude. Now, I remember a few years ago when I was working in the counseling center at the U of U, a young girl came in, and she was a freshman, and she was way, way overweight. She wore mismatched socks. Her dress was unpressed and unkempt. Her hair was uncombed. She was a mess. She was crying, and she was saying, I'm LDS, I'd like to get married, but nobody will date me. And she said, I'm nothing but a big, fat slob. Those were her exact words. And I said, well, gee. And I looked at her, and I would kind of agree with her, you know, but it was very obvious that she was doing nothing to present herself as an attractive, beautiful person. And so it became very clear that she had a very negative self-image about herself. And because she didn't like herself very much, she was behaving and acting and dressing and everything in this way. So I said, well, maybe what you ought to do is go on a diet. She said, I've been on 20 of them. Nothing works. In fact, she said, in our home, I've talked my parents into putting big padlocks on every cupboard that has food in it. And around the refrigerator and freezer, they have a big chain with a big padlock, and everybody has keys but me. And I said, well, gee, doesn't that help, you know, take off weight because you can't get at the food at home, so you can't snack? She said, well, I got a younger brother, and we kind of have some competition going on, and we fight a lot and everything like that. So in order to get even with me, he leaves the key out where I can get it. So this was a Monday that I was seeing her at the counseling center. She said, for example, last night, about midnight, I came down in my pajamas, and there he'd left the key out, knew I could find it there, and I opened up the refrigerator, and I took out 2.5 gallons of Snellgrove Super Rich Double Fudge Triple Nut Ice Cream. And I'm on a diet. And I ripped the lid off, you know, and I looked at it, and for about 10 or 15 minutes, I struggled with temptation. And then she said, finally, I couldn't help it. And you know what I did? I put my face down into it, and I went, gobble, 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 gobble. You know? And she said, I must have eaten about a third of it, you know, crying all the time, hating myself. My face was smeared with ice cream chunks of my hair, everything like that. She said, it was awful, you know. And then I went in, cleaned up, you know, locked up the refrigerator again, and she said, you know, that's my life, you know. It doesn't work to go on diets and so forth. Well, it became very clear to me that she was engaging in self-destructive behavior, and that if she didn't like herself, and the way she punished herself would be to do these things that were not, in a sense, would bless her life or help her or whatever. So in counseling, what we tried to help her do was, and again, to create a positive image about herself, to respect herself, to feel good about herself, and to wear socks that match, to comb her hair, and to do all kinds of things that would make her attractive. And you know what? A year later, boy, let me tell you, we turned her power on, we got her moving, we got her feeling better about herself. A year later, she got a proposal for marriage, and she turned it down. She said, he's not good enough. And 6 months later, she got another proposal for marriage. She said, this guy is great, but we're not matched personality-wise. And then about 8 months later, she met the guy that was it. And they got engaged, they got married, and they got 2 kids now. So what I'm saying is that even if you get into a negative cycle, and sometimes we all do that, or to a cycle of depression and things like that, you know, you can move out. But what you need to do to move out is you need to have some good friends and buddies around you. You've got to have a support system. And then sometimes you need to have somebody you trust. Doesn't have to be a professional counselor. Could be a favorite uncle, could be your dad, it could be all kinds of people. But you need to have somebody you can go to kind of talk with them, get their ideas about things, who can be there to be your support system so you can get out of the hole that you've sort of got into. Now let me just kind of finish, our time is almost up, talking about depression, because this is something that is very common to all of us. It's the common cold of mental illness. And there are 3 kinds of depression. One is a biological depression, and that is it has to do with an imbalance of neurotransmitter chemicals in the brain, something you inherit. In other words, everything can be going great, but you can still be depressed, but it's caused by this neurological imbalance of certain neurotransmitter chemicals in the brain. And now with some of the modern wonderful medications, if chosen wisely, they can really, really make a difference, and you can get out of it. There's also what we call reactive or situational depressions. And this is caused by unfortunate life circumstances, a death of a loved one or loss of a job or a romance goes sour and so forth. And when you feel depressed here, it's appropriate. It's normal. You ought to feel a little depressed. But what's not appropriate is to stay in this depression for any great length of time. People that are basically healthy will crawl out of that, even though you've broken up with your boyfriend or girlfriend or you've maybe had a tough semester at school or something like that. But reactive or situational depressions, the way you deal with it, again, is have a support system, have some good buddies that are there for you, and then you change what you're doing. You know, you get out of a class maybe that's not good for you, or you get out of a relationship maybe that's destructive, you know, and you solve whatever the stressors are out in the environment so that life goes better for you. Then there's a 3rd kind of a depression, and that is, it's called a neurotic depression. And that is, these are people that see everything through black-colored, dark-colored glasses. Life is sad. They see everything from kind of a sad point of view. And this can be treated with some wonderful new modern therapies. We call them rational cognitive therapies to help you take those glasses off and to see life from a better point of view. But some people who get locked into these kinds of negative ways of looking at everything and neurotic depression, this is usually caused by a lot of pain growing up and a lot of failure experiences, and you know, dad and mother get divorced and their lives are way off balance, and we just have a series of very, very negative experiences growing up. And so what happens is that we're like Rocky in the ring for 101 rounds, and we get kind of punchy, and it affects us. And what I'm saying is we do need some help, but you can get out. You don't have to stay there. So with all the depressions, there are solutions. So let me tell you, the most wonderful thing about the work that I'm involved in is to see people change. And no matter where you are, life can get better, and still better, and still better. But those waves don't stop coming. It's just that you learn how to handle them better when the challenges and stress of life occur. Because that's what Earth life is all about. For us to be tested, for us to grow, for us to experience wonderful, great things, but also for us to face some big challenges too. There's nothing wrong with that. That's good. That's healthy. And if we handle it appropriately, our lives will grow great. It's been a great pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity to meet with you today. Thanks, Yvonne.
You're listening to Sunday Fireside. We just presented a talk by Brother Victor Klein, a professor of psychology at the University of Utah. The title of his talk today, Making Life Work for You, a talk delivered at the Ephraim LDS Institute of Religion as part of their Friday Forum series, February 28th in the year 1991. On the program, Sunday Fireside. It's time now for the program You and Your World, featuring outstanding talks by general authorities of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Presenting a talk today by Elder Neil A. Maxwell, a member of the Quorum of 12 Apostles of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. This talk delivered during the October 4th, 1992 General Conference of the Church. The title of the talk, Dedication to the Lord.
18 years ago, from this same pulpit, I pled with those who stood indecisively on the porch of the church to come fully inside. Today, my plea is to those members already inside, but whose discipleship is casual. Individuals whom we love, whose gifts and talents are much needed in building the kingdom. Any call for greater consecration is, of course, really a call for all of us. But these remarks are not primarily for those who are steadily striving, who genuinely seek to keep God's commandments and yet sometimes fall short. Nor is this primarily for those few in deliberate noncompliance, including some who cast off on intellectual and behavioral bungee cords in search of new sensations, only to be jerked about by the old heresies and the old sins. Instead, these comments are essentially for the honorable members who are skimming over the surface instead of deepening their discipleship, and who are casually engaged rather than anxiously engaged. Though nominal in their participation, their reservations and hesitations inevitably show through. They may even pass through our holy temples, but alas, they do not let the holy temples pass through them. Such members accept callings, but not all of the accompanying responsibilities. Hence, their church chores must often be done by those already anxiously engaged. Some regard themselves as merely resting between church callings. But we are never in between as to this soaring call from Jesus. What manner of men and women ought ye to be? Verily I say unto you, even as I am. It is never safe to rest regarding that calling. In fact, being valiant in one's testimony of Jesus includes striving to become more like him in mind, heart, and attributes. Becoming this manner of men and women is the ultimate expression of orthodoxy. All are free to choose, of course, and we would not have it otherwise. Unfortunately, however, when some choose slackness, they are choosing not only for themselves, but for the next generation and the next. Small equivocations in parents can produce large deviations in their children. Earlier generations in a family may have reflected dedication, while some in the current generation evidence equivocation. Sadly, in the next, some may choose dissension as erosion takes its toll. While casual members are not unrighteous, they often avoid appearing to be too righteous by seeming less committed than they really are, an ironic form of hypocrisy. Some of these otherwise honorable members mistakenly regard the church as an institution, but not as a kingdom. They know the doctrines of the kingdom, but more as a matter of recitation than of real comprehension. Casual members are usually very busy with the cares and the things of the world, much as Honorable Amulek once was. Called many times, he would not hear. He really knew concerning the truths of the gospel, but Amulek would not acknowledge that he knew. One common characteristic of the honorable but slack is their disdain for the seemingly unexciting duties of discipleship, such as daily prayer, regular reading of the scriptures, attendance at sacrament meeting, paying a full tithe, and participating in the holy temples. Such disdain is especially dangerous in today's world of raging relativism and of belching sensualism, a world in which, if many utter the name of deity at all, it is only as verbal punctuation or as an expression of exclamation, not adoration. In contrast, those sincerely striving for greater consecration neither cast off their commitments nor the holy garment. They avoid obscenity, keep the law of chastity, pay their tithes, and love and serve their spouses and children. As good neighbors, they bear one another's burdens, mourn with those that mourn, comfort those in need of comfort, and valiantly stand as witnesses of God at all times and in all places and in all things. When the determination is first made to become more spiritually settled, there is an initial vulnerability. It is hard to break with the past. But once we begin, we see how friends who would hold us back spiritually are not true friends at all. Any chiding from them reflects either resentment or unconscious worry that somehow they are being deserted. In any attempt to explain to them, our tongue is able to speak only the smallest part. We continue to care for them, but care for our duty to God more. Brigham Young counseled candidly, "Some do not understand duties which do not coincide with their natural feelings and affections. There are duties which are above affection." End of quote. It is only fair to warn that any determination to seek greater consecration will soon expose what we yet lack, a painful but necessary thing. Remember the rich, righteous young man who was told by Jesus, "One thing thou lackest." Ananias and Sapphira, otherwise good members of the church, kept back a portion instead of consecrating their all. Some would never sell Jesus for 30 pieces, but they would not give him their all either. Unfortunately, we tend to think of consecration only in terms of property and money, but there are so many ways of keeping back part. One might be giving of money and time and yet hold back a significant portion of himself. One might share talents publicly, yet privately retain a particular pride. One might hold back from kneeling before God's throne, and yet bow to a particular gallery of peers. One might accept a church calling, but have his heart more set on maintaining a certain role in the world. Still others find it easier to bend their knees than their minds. Exciting exploration is preferred to plodding implementation. Speculation seems more fun than consecration. and so is trying to soften the hard doctrines instead of submitting to them. Worse still, by not obeying, these few members lack real knowing. Lacking real knowing, they cannot defend their faith and may become critics instead of defenders. A few of the latter end up in the self-reinforcing and self-congratulating Hyde Park corner of the church, which they provincially mistake for the whole of the church, as if London's real Hyde Park corner were Parliament, Whitehall, Buckingham Palace, and all of England combined. Only greater consecration will cure ambivalence and casualness in any of us. As already noted, the tutoring challenges arising from increased consecration may be severe, but reflect the divine mercy necessary to induce further consecration. If we have grown soft, hard times may be necessary. Deprivation may prepare us for further consecration, though we shudder at the thought. If we are too easily contented, God may administer a dose of divine discontent. His long-suffering thus becomes very necessary to maximize our agency and development. But he is not an indulgent father. We cannot bear all things now, but the Lord will lead us along as we give place in our thoughts and schedules and give away our sins in order to make room to receive all that God can give us. Each of us, brothers and sisters, is an innkeeper who decides if there is room for Jesus. Consecration is the only surrender which is also a victory. It brings release from the raucous, overpopulated cell block of selfishness and emancipation from the dark prison of pride. Yet instead of striving for greater consecration, it is so easy to go on performing casually in half-hearted compliance, as if hoping to ride to paradise on a golf cart. But is being consecrated and swallowed up a threat to our individuality? No. Heavenly Father is only asking us to lose the old self in order to find the new and the real self. It is not a question of losing our identity, but of finding our true identity. When at last we are truly pointed homeward, then the world's pointing fingers of scorn can better be endured. As we come to know to whom we belong, the other forms of belonging cease to mean very much. Likewise, as Jesus begins to have a real place in our lives, we are much less concerned with losing our places in the world. When our minds really catch hold of the significance of Jesus' atonement, the world's hold on us loosens. Increased consecration is not so much a demand for more hours of church work as it is for more awareness of whose work this really is. For now, consecration may not require giving up worldly possessions so much as being less possessed by them. Only when things begin to come into focus with an eye single do we see things as they really are. What of you awaits? Only to the degree that we respond to life's temptations as Jesus did, who gave no heed unto them, will we be free, free at last. True orthodoxy thus brings safety and felicity. It is not only correctness, but happiness. Strange, isn't it? Even the very word orthodoxy has fallen into disfavor with some. As society gets more and more flaky, a few rush forward to warn shrilly against orthodoxy. Remember how, with Pharaoh's angry army in hot pursuit, ancient Israel aligned themselves with the Lord's instructions. Moses stretched forth his hand and the Red Sea parted, with towering walls of water on each side. Israel walked through a narrow passage obediently and no doubt quickly. There were no warnings about conforming that day. There are passages ahead which will require a similar obedience as prophets lead the men and women of Christ in a straight and narrow course. Becoming more like Jesus in thought and behavior is not grinding and repressing, but emancipating and discovering. Unorthodoxy in behavior and intellect is just the opposite. A little pornography may lead not only to child and spouse abuse, but it slowly sucks out the marrow of self-esteem. A little tendency to gossip can lead not only to bearing serious false witness, but more often to malicious whispers, which, unfortunately, memory will warehouse as a shout. A little criticism of the brethren, which seems harmless enough, may not only damage other members, but can even lead to one setting himself up as a substitute light unto the world. Yes, happily, some such prodigals do come back, but they usually walk alone, unaccompanied by those they once led astray. Jesus counseled his disciples, "Wherefore settle this in your hearts, that you will do the things which I shall teach and command you." Getting thus settled precedes consecration. The prophet Joseph Smith said, "Gospel knowledge does away with darkness, suspense, and doubt, and that there is no pain so awful as that of suspense." Being settled keeps us from responding to every little ripple of dissent as if it were a tidal wave. We are to be disciples, not oscillators, like a reed shaken in the wind. More members need the immense relief and peace which can come from being settled, without which those individuals will be like the troubled sea when it cannot rest. There is another special reason to become settled. We will live in a time in which all things shall be in commotion. The uncertainties, upheavals, and topsy-turviness of today's world will be such that those who vacillate and equivocate will be tossed about by severe turbulence. Finally, if we shrink from deeper consecration, then we are not worthy of him who, for our sake, refused to shrink in the midst of his deepening agony during the atonement. Instead, Jesus pressed forward, giving his all and completing his marvelous preparations unto the children of men. Consider, what if Jesus' mortal messiahship had consisted only of remarkable sermons, or was further enhanced with healings and other miracles, but without Gethsemane's and Calvary's awful but consecrated hours of atonement? How then would we regard Jesus' ministry? Where would mankind be? Brothers and sisters, whatever we embrace instead of Jesus and his work will keep us from being embraced by him upon entering his kingdom. May we get settled and prepare now for that marvelous moment then. I ask in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
You've been listening to the program, You and Your World, featuring outstanding talks by general authorities of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, featuring a talk today by Elder Neil A. Maxwell, a member of the Quorum of 12 Apostles of the LDS Church. The title of his talk, Dedication to the Lord. This talk delivered during the October 4th, 1992 General Conference of the Church. On the program, You and Your World. And you're listening to Sunday Fireside. You've been listening to Sunday Fireside, featuring outstanding inspirational talks and discussions on religious topics from popular LDS speakers and general authorities of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Please join us again next week at the same time for Sunday Fireside.